On Valentine's Day 1989, a BBC reporter asked Salman Rushdie how it felt to be sentenced to death by Ayatollah Khomeini. "It doesn't feel good," he replied simply, while thinking, "I'm a dead man." This moment marked the beginning of an extraordinary saga, a novelist forced underground for over a decade, protected by armed guards, his very existence becoming a symbol in the global conflict between religious extremism and freedom of expression. Joseph Anton, Rushdie's alias during hiding, combining the names of Joseph Conrad and Anton Chekhov, chronicles this astonishing journey. Despite its grave subject matter, the memoir maintains Rushdie's characteristic wit and literary flair, offering both a political thriller and a deeply personal account of a writer determined to reclaim his life and identity. The Satanic Verses began as fragments around themes of migration and transformation, deeply personal to Rushdie as an Indian-born writer living in Britain. The novel took shape from disparate elements, drowning pilgrims reimagined, immigrant London transformed into Brick Hall, and characters inspired by people in his own life. Migration, he wrote, puts into crisis everything about identity and selfhood and culture and belief, so his novel must perform the crisis it describes. The book's opening scene came after Air India Flight 182 was destroyed by terrorists, killing 329 people, including his childhood friend. This tragedy inspired the beginning, where two characters survive their plane's destruction and land on an English beach. Far from being a quick insult, as opponents later claimed, the book took over 4 years to write, what Rushdie considered his least political, most personal exploration of migration and metamorphosis. When published in September 1988, the Satanic Verses briefly existed as merely a literary event. Victoria Glendinning called it better than Midnight's Children, while Angela Carter praised it as sometimes hilarious, extraordinary. But literary discourse would soon be drowned by outrage as the real book vanished beneath an imaginary one supposedly insulting Islam. The first trouble came when India Today published misleading headlines that invited controversy. Indian parliamentarian Syed Shahabuddin responded with an open letter titled, "You did this with satanic forethought, Mr. Rushdie," beginning the demonization campaign creating Satan Rushdie. By October 6, 1988, the book was banned in India despite the country's proclaimed secularism. Rushdie responded with an angry open letter to Prime Minister Gandhi asking, "What sort of India do you wish to govern?" The next day, the first death threat arrived. By January 1989, protesters in Bradford burned his book, nailing it to wood before setting it aflame. Watching the footage later, Rushdie thought of Heinrich Heine's prophetic line, "Where they burn books, they will in the end burn people too." The fatwa, delivered on Valentine's Day 1989, made Rushdie the most endangered person in Britain after the Queen. He was immediately placed under police protection, given an armored Jaguar with doors so heavy they could injure if they swung shut. Neither his son Zafar nor his former partner Clarissa received protection, as they weren't considered targets. Still, fear for them preyed on him daily. His sister Samin analyzed the fatwa as Khomeini's attempt to regain political momentum after the failed Iraq War. At the Ligon Arms Hotel, Rushdie was given a panic button that didn't work. Police presented him with a craven apology statement, hinting it was required for continued protection. His compromise statement, expressing regret for distress but not apologizing for the book, was rejected by both British Muslims and Iranian leadership. Meanwhile, he learned he must find his own safe accommodations, contrary to public belief about government safe houses. Friends offered refuge at their Welsh farm, where he experienced the humiliation of hiding from a farmer, feeling deeply ashamed in a culture where honor mattered greatly. After years of creative struggle under protection, Rushdie finally reconnected with his writing through vivid memories of Kerala, which sparked his novel The Moor's Last Sigh. Walking through Cochin's historic Jewtown district in his mind, he found himself drawn into narrow lanes and spice-scented markets where characters emerged, beckoning him into their richly imagined world. This creative breakthrough came despite horrific violence, the shooting of his Norwegian publisher, the stabbing of his Italian translator, and the murder of his Japanese translator. Against this backdrop of terror, Rushdie rediscovered his creative sanctuary within the written word. He forced himself back into old routines with methodical determination, writing in pajamas before even brushing his teeth, following Hemingway's dictum about applying the seat of the pants to the seat of the chair. During this period, he completed his East-West story collection, which showcased his range with tales about Indian diplomats obsessed with Star Trek, a friend's descent into mental illness, and a chess-playing janitor finding connection in an alien land. While Britain seemed ambivalent about Rushdie's plight, America offered a dramatically different reception. At the Senate, Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Senator Leahy drafted a resolution of support. Rushdie stood at the heart of American power, with senators behind him like a backup group, all holding copies of his book. This stark contrast to British politicians' attitudes continued years later when Rushdie met President Clinton at the White House. Clinton asked directly, "What can I do for you?" When Rushdie requested U.S. support against the Iranian fatwa, Clinton simply nodded. "Yes, you can say that, because it's true." Freedom ultimately came unexpectedly through a family escape to America, where, remarkably, no protection was required. The sensation of anonymity was intoxicating as he experienced New York with fresh eyes, repeatedly exclaiming, "Freedom!" In 2002, after attending the Oscars, Rushdie returned to London where Nick Cottage from Special Branch cryptically suggested he make arrangements for later in the day. The next morning came the news he'd waited 13 years to hear. The threat level had been drastically reduced. Protection was being withdrawn. The officer simply shook his hand and walked out of his life with startling abruptness. At their farewell party, Rob Connolly, who had completed a degree in post-colonial literature during his service, gave Rushdie the bullet Mike Merrill had accidentally fired in the Bishop's Avenue house. Finally free, Rushdie walked out and hailed a cab. Looking back, Rushdie saw his family flourish, his nieces advancing in their careers, his sons growing into fine young men. Though not everything ended perfectly, his most important victory was survival. He had continued writing and reclaimed his life. The battle over the satanic verses remained unresolved. Neither the book nor he had been suppressed, but the dead remained dead, and a climate of fear made similar books harder to publish. Yet Rushdie had returned to his essence as a storyteller, rededicating himself to the art that had claimed his heart since youth, to live again in the universe of Once Upon a Time.